20.
Hi, good morning. My name is Whitney Baxter, and I wanted to tell you all briefly about the Spring Career Conference. That's this Saturday. It's going to start at 11 o'clock in the morning and run until about 5 in the afternoon. We've spoken a lot in this class about finding our passion and our motivation, and that's what this event's about. We've surveyed the student body, we've found your dream jobs, and we brought in industry professionals and people who've done them to pretty much tell you how you get in the door. And so it's going to go on all afternoon in Tickner Lounge. And whether you're looking for a full-time job or an internship, or you just want to learn from someone who's worked in Hollywood or in the sports industry, this is an event for you. So you're going to see it all over campus on house email lists, and you're going to see posters up. But it's in Tickner Lounge on Saturday afternoon. Thanks.
Okay. Hi. Good morning. And. We have a second announcement. Two more announcements. One is that there is another announcement. The first announcement is that there is a survey which is on the web, which is on factors affecting motivation. I looked at the survey. It's very interesting. It will take you 5 minutes, highly recommend taking it. It's hcs.harvard.edu/FPEP. So, encourage you to take it, and now for the fourth announcement.
Hi, I just want to say, I hope this is working, that tomorrow night, Wednesday night, from 8 to 10 p.m. in the Leverett Private Dining Room, there's going to be a model search. It's going to be for Freeze College Magazine in conjunction with Co-Ed Magazine, and if you're interested, we strongly encourage you to come. It'll only take about 10 to 15 minutes, and it will be a lot of fun. All right, hope to see you there.
What is it? Model. Can faculty attend or no? Okay. All right. Hi, good morning. So, let's pick up where we left last time. I will address more questions on Thursday. I want to jump right into the material. We have a lot to get through. So we talked about change. We started by talking about how difficult change is, but how it's also possible, how the exception proves the rule. And the question is no longer whether change is possible or not, but rather how change is possible. And this is what we'll address today and in the next session. In many ways, this captures the essence of what this course is about. So many of the things we'll talk about today, we've touched on before, or we will address in greater depth later on in this semester. So the anatomy of change. Remember, until 1998, what psychologists believed, what they really thought, the schema that they had in their mind was that the brain doesn't change beyond our early childhood. So initially, the change is through birth, up to early experiences. Some of Freud's work certainly affected this. And neuropsychologists, physiologists, actually backed that up with their research, saying the change, the brain doesn't change. This, of course, gave credence to a lot of the research out there. One of them about, remember the twin studies? The stochastic, happiness is a stochastic phenomenon, showing that happiness can really change beyond what you were endowed genetically. It gave credence to other research, showing that self-esteem doesn't really change beyond the age of 7. But that was until 1998. In 1998, researchers, primary amongst them, Richard Davidson, whom you will read, identified the neuroplasticity of the brain. That the brain doesn't only change in our teens. It changes till the day we die. They had experiments that I mentioned with taxi drivers, just got their license or were about to get their license in London, and they had to memorize the map of London. That part of the visual cortex in their brain actually got bigger after they had studied, or musicians playing the same piece over and over and over again. Their brain actually changes shape, it grows, whether they are five years old or 85 years old. The brain changes. Now, what does the brain look like? The brain, we use the metaphor, remember, of a river and streams. There are neural pathways in the brain, some of them very wide, some of them very narrow. A very wide pathway means that there is a lot of action there, a lot of neurons firing in that direction. And it's like a river, it's self-reinforcing. So if you have a river and water flows through it, the water erodes it further, i.e. makes it bigger. The same with neural pathways. It can be created and can be a tiny neural pathway. And then that neural pathway attracts action and it becomes bigger. It's self-reinforcing, like a river becomes bigger. And that's how we form habits. In other words, a habit can be formed by a small, seemingly insignificant event. Something that happened to us when we were 3 or 33. Something tiny. And then that tiny neural pathway is reinforced by more experience, and after a while it doesn't always, but it can become a habit, a much wider river. And as John Dryden said, the British poet, we first make our habits, and then our habits make us. And it is very difficult to change habits once they are formed. Difficult, but possible. By the way, it is easier to change habits your age than my age. Why? Because the brain actually develops, continues to grow until our mid-20s. Again, that doesn't mean we can't change it when we are 80, but it's just more difficult. But it's still possible to form new neural pathways. And also, if action stops flowing through a neural pathway, it withers and dies. It's use it or lose it. Just like rivers, if no water flows it over time, it is covered with sand. And there is no river there anymore, no neural pathway, to use the analogy. So that's the anatomy of change. Now, within our brain, there are healthy and unhealthy neural pathways. Neural pathways that are empowering, neural pathways that are disempowering. And that's important to understand which are which, so that we can fortify the ones that make us happier, more optimistic, more successful in the long run? And how can we weaken the ones that are disempowering us, that are making us weaker, less happy? Let's look at some negative channels that we spoke about. So we spoke about the fault finder. What does the fault finder do? Every time there is an event, immediately it goes into the neural pathway that brings it to the issue of this is bad. This is a negative event. I'm complaining about this. I'm unhappy about this. Or a consummate warrior, or a person who is very anxious. Every time there is an event with the slightest trigger, because, remember, the neural pathway is thick on the part of the brain that worries, more action is attracted to it. And then every little event makes us worried. We become very anxious very quickly. I realized that I had a fortified negative neural pathway when I was a senior here. There was a certain fellowship that I'd really wanted. I wanted to go study, to go for further study in Cambridge, England. And I tried hard for this fellowship. I got the interview and ultimately got the fellowship. As you can imagine, I was ecstatic. I mean, this is what I was dreaming of. There were 3 fellowships awarded my year, same kind of fellowships. The day after I got the fellowship, I started to think, wait a minute, why didn't I get one of the other 2? They were the same. I mean, I didn't know they were exactly this, they were identical. But still, my mind immediately gravitated toward the negative. Why? Because my negative neural pathway, the fault finder, was so strong that even, and arguably, positive event, as far as I was concerned, the most positive event that I could hope for at that time happened, I still gravitated toward the negative. And I realized something was wrong there. Remember what we talked about? It's mostly the inside rather than the outside that matters. External circumstances matter, but they matter very little relative to what's going on in our brain, what's going on inside us. But there are also positive channels. The merit finder looks for good things, looks for the lemonade everywhere. And when it's not there, he or she makes it. Person who is always happy, finding reasons, actively looking for reasons to be happy. A little event, a flower, the sun, the weather, food in Quincy. Events like these make them happy. Why? Because the neural pathways of the positive are reinforced, they're strong. So every event naturally flows in that direction, like water flowing into a big river, and it reinforces it. One of the positive channels that I've been working on and have been cultivating is the notion of what happens once I fail. So the path that I've been cultivating is the following. Failure is opportunity. Now, every time when something doesn't go well for me, it's almost automatic. It goes, okay, so what can I learn from it? I experience the experience for sure, but I also remember learn to fail or fail to learn. And I've reinforced it so many times that now it's almost automatic. What have I learned? What opportunity is there? Not it happened for the best, but how can I make the best of what happened? Automatic neural pathway that I've created starting when I was in my early 20s. There's research now on the structure of the brain that shows actually where we have more positive versus more negative neural pathways. For instance, in the prefrontal cortex, people who tend toward the positive have a relatively large left side of the neofrontal cortex relative to the right side. In other words, that's where the action is when we interpret an event positively. And what has been shown through research by Davidson and others is that for people who are positive, this part of the brain is larger and there is more activity there. Again, like a river, there's more water there, and as a result of that water, it gets even bigger. More activity there, as a result of this activity, it becomes even more fortified, an upward spiral, versus the opposite can be a downward spiral. If it's a negative pathway. This explains why the same trigger can yield different events. I have the privilege of living with a consummate merit finder, my wife. We would often come back from a party, you know, a group of us would go and we would have the after party gossip. And people would say about a specific person, you know, this person didn't stop talking and, you know, didn't let anyone in on the conversation. What would my wife say? What an amazing person. She's so passionate about her work. Again, same event, but very different interpretation based on the neural pathways that we have. The good news is, as we've spoken all along, is that we can change. It's not just about throwing in information, the trigger, it's about transformation, changing the shape of the brain. Literally changing the shape of the brain, fortifying the neural pathways that are more positive, that we want to fortify, while weakening over time, drying out, not entirely getting rid of, but drying out the negative ones. Karen Horney, remember I mentioned her at the very first class, psychologist who's, I would argue, the grandmother of positive psychology, says that we can't really get completely rid of our neuroses, and we all have neuroses. It could be in the form of perfectionism, anxiety, whatever it is. We can't get rid of them entirely, but with work, we can weaken them. We weaken them first by accepting that they are there, giving ourselves the permission to be human, and then by just drawing them out, channeling the trigger toward the positive as opposed toward the negative. And today what we'll talk about is exactly how we do that. We're going to address two types of change. The first type is the gradual approach to change. This is the normal, safer way to change. It takes time. It's like the analogy with Michelangelo, chipping away the excess stone. Gradually, it's like water smoothing rock. It takes time, sometimes imperceptible. Again, like watching the airplane on the screen. When we go for a transatlantic flight, for example, we can't see the airplane move. It's moving too slowly. But if we fall asleep and get up again, the airplane has moved. So sometimes it's only in retrospect that we can see the change. But this is the usual safer approach to change, and it's important. It's the primary way to change. Most change happens that way. No quick fixes. There's another form of change, which is the acute approach. This is the immediate, sudden change. This would be equivalent like taking a sledgehammer and breaking the ground and making a river or a beginning of a river where water starts to flow. But that's not quick fix either. It takes a lot of preparation. To continue the metaphor, you need to be very strong and you need to work on your strength to lift up a heavy sledgehammer before you can drop it and make the immediate acute change. These are the two forms of changes that we'll take, neither of which are a quick fix. The attempt, the belief in quick fix, only leads to unhappiness. It leads to frustration because it's not realistic. It would be like waking up in the morning and saying, I want to fly, and getting very frustrated because I can't fly. That's the way reality is. Yes, it would be wonderful if I could give you now a prescription for lifelong happiness. It would be wonderful if I could give you a prescription for being a merit finder tomorrow morning, to take the pill, you know, the blue rather than the red pill. It doesn't work that way. It takes time. But before we go into how we change, this is not a trivial question. Do I really want to change? And when I ask this question, I'm not just asking your conscious mind who will say, yes, of course, I want to be happier. Of course, I want to be more optimistic, more of a merit finder. Yeah, of course, I want to have higher self-esteem and believe in myself. I'm not just asking your conscious mind. I'm also asking your subconscious mind here. Because sometimes they're at odds. Let me explain what I mean by introducing a fascinating study conducted again by our very own Professor Alan Langer. She ran this study with her colleague, and the study was about change. What it asked people is whether they wanted to change a list of traits, whether they had tried to change a list of traits. And here are some of the traits that she propose. Rigidity, do you want to be less gullible? Do you want to be less grim? And most people would say yes to many of the traits that she put on the long list. And then she asked them a second question. Okay, so you want to change these things. Did you change? Were you able to change over the years? Some of them they said yes, to others they said no, I'm still trying, to no avail. This was part one of the study, part two of the study. She gave them another list of characteristics and asked them to evaluate how important these characteristics were to them. On the list were characteristics such as consistency, such as trustworthiness, such as seriousness. And now here is what she found. If you look at these pairs, they're parallel. This is the positive side of rigidity would be, I'm consistent. The positive side of being gullible is, I'm trustworthy. The positive side of being grim is, I'm serious. And she asked the people, not knowing that the two parts of the study were connected, how important are these and other traits to you, positive traits? Now here are the results. The people who evaluated the positives highly. For example, who said, yes, it is very important for me to be trustworthy, were also the people who had the most difficulty overcoming their gullibility. Subconsciously. The people who were most rigid and couldn't get over the rigidity also valued highly the trait of being serious. Isn't that interesting? In other words, they didn't want to give up consistency, and hence their subconscious prevented them from also giving up the rigidity. The subconscious didn't differentiate between the two. You know, when I read this study, I suddenly got it. I understood why it has been so difficult for me for years to overcome my perfectionism. Because what traits do we associate with perfectionism? Tell me, what kind of traits would you associate with perfectionism? Competence, intelligence, ambition. I didn't want to give up these characteristics. I didn't want to give up my drive, my ambition. I loved that about myself. So my subconscious, even though I knew perfectionism was hurting me in so many areas in my life, and again, we're going to devote two whole lectures to perfectionism and overcoming it, because I've heard there are one or two of us at Harvard. So we're going to devote a lot of time to this, but before we can begin to change it, we first need to understand what's the positive side of this. Or here are some other examples. Worry and anxiety. What could be a positive side of worry and anxiety that might prevent me from getting rid of my, of being overly worried? Sorry? Thoughtfulness, absolutely. Cautiousness, attention to details. I mean, all these things we associate with, well, let me worry because I want to pay attention to this. Sense of responsibility, guilt. The other side of it could be empathy and sensitivity. I want to be a feeling person. Guilt is important. It's part of being empathic if I do something wrong. This one was very big for me. I wanted to take more time off. I knew I was working myself too hard. I was on the rat race. What may prevent a person from relaxing more? Work ethics? What else? Why wouldn't you take more time off if you know that it's good for you? Sorry? Future-mindedness? Absolutely. I'm giving up something in the future by relaxing now, or so we think, so the subconscious thinks. I don't want to lose my edge. Fault-finding. We talked a lot about this. We don't want to give fault-finding because we associate it with being realistic. At least our subconscious mind does. And finally, many people don't give themselves the permission to be happy. Why don't we give ourselves the permission to be happy? There are many reasons. One of them is because we know that no pain, no gain. And if I'm not experiencing gain, then it must mean I'm not improving as much. It must mean I'm doing something wrong. And again, all these things can go on the subconscious mind or the conscious mind, but they make a big difference. And this is what Langer's study so beautifully depicted. So what's the challenge? The challenge is to have a more nuanced understanding of what we want to change and what we want to maintain. Yes, I want to overcome my perfectionism in the sense of the fear of failure that prevents me from trying things out, from enjoying the process. But I don't want to give up my ambition, and I don't have to. In this respect, we can eat the cake and leave it whole. I want to be happy, but I don't want to stop improving. Well, what we'll talk about a lot in the perfectionism lecture is how we can be both happier and more successful by pursuing excellence rather than being perfectionists. Or I do want to take more time off. We'll talk next time about the importance of recreation because it leads to creation, to higher levels of creativity, and to more enjoyment. I do want to relax more, and I need to understand where I can without losing my future-mindedness or without losing the edge. A more nuanced understanding of the differences can help us, as a first step, can help us understand where is it that I want to change and where is it that I don't want to change, and shift that barrier that so many of us have toward change. This little study made a big difference in my, specifically with perfectionism, which was the area that I was working on. What I'd like you to do at home is think about it. Think about areas in your life that you want to change, and think about the positive, the benefits, so to speak, of that characteristic. Because if we don't change, there's very often a perceived benefit to having it. Let's go to basics. Told you this wasn't Math 55A. The ABCs of psychology: affect, behavior, cognition. This is the approach that we're going to take toward change. The affect, the emotional approach. The behavior, taking action toward change. Cognition, the thought, the mind. We can take each one of these approaches. We can change, and I've spoken about this before, we can change our emotion, or we can change our experience of life, be happier by directing, going to our emotion directly. This is done through things like meditation. Medication is also going straight to our emotion, to our physiology. We can also change through behavior, by changing our behavior. We can also change by changing our thought. Cognitive therapy is about changing our thought structure, thought process. Each one of them is important. What I'm going to strongly recommend here is that when we try and change, we do all three at the same time. Why? Going back to our metaphor. If we try and change a habit, such as perfectionism, or such as fault-finding, or pessimism, remember, we first make our habits, and then our habits make us. If we try and change it and create a new neural pathway, this new neural pathway, to use the analogy, will be taken away, wiped out by a flood of water, unless we fortify it with as many ways as possible. We need all the help we can get to change a habit. And that's why we want to use affect, behavior, and cognition simultaneously. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go over all three. It's difficult to differentiate because there are things that touch on all three. For example, writing. In writing, we're certainly behaving, we're doing something, we're thinking, and it also arouses emotions. But I'm going to divide the change into a sort of a taxonomy. And within each, within the A, within the B, and within the C, I'm going to look at one example of a gradual change, like water and stone, and an example of a acute change, bless you, like a sledgehammer. Let's begin with emotion. Emotion, motion, and motivation are etymologically connected, and they're also metaphysically connected. In order to be motivated, in order to attain motion, we need emotion, and therefore it's the first prerequisite of effecting change. There are various ways to change our attitudes through emotions. The one I will focus on, and one we'll focus on in its own lecture, is mindfulness meditation. Various reasons. First of all, it works. And there is increasing research on it. A lot of the research on meditation, which we'll elaborate on, comes from two people, one of them being Herbert Benson from the Harvard Medical School, who's done a lot of work on the relaxation response, meditation. And the other person is John Kabat-Zinn, who's a professor at the medical school, also at Worcester, University of Massachusetts. And here is what Jon Kabat-Zinn has to say about mindfulness meditation. Cultivating mindfulness can lead to the discovery of deep realms of relaxation, calmness, and insight within yourself. The path to it in any moment lies no farther than your own body and mind and your own breathing. The amazing thing about mindfulness is that it's accessible to everyone at every moment. And it is such a powerful intervention. Remember we talked about how difficult change is, whether through the Somerville study or the twin studies or returning back to our base level, to the set point. Change is hard. But this works, and it's such a simple technique. You know, the 5-year intervention in the Somerville Cambridge study may have not worked. This works. In fact, there are studies that show that within 8 weeks, our brain actually changes if we meditate regularly. Within 8 weeks, new neural pathways are created, old ones are fortified. After 8 weeks of meditation, the prefrontal cortex, the left side, grows in proportion to the right side, makes us more prone to happiness. That's amazing. 8 weeks. Jon Kabat-Zinn again, all of us have the capacity to be mindful. All it involves is cultivating our ability to pay attention in the present moment. Ultimately, the goal is to be present at every moment. What meditation is, it's like going to the gym. It's practicing being present, focusing on our breath. Let's try and experience it now for just 2 minutes. So for those of you who have not meditated, who have not experienced it, let's have a mini meditation session with a purpose. So what we're going to do now, again, those of you who feel comfortable with it, you can close your eyes. Those who don't close your eyes. Sit with your back straight, shoulders relaxed. You don't need to take notes now. Sit up comfortably, both feet planted firmly on the ground. Feel grounded. And breathe. Breathe deeply to the depth of your stomach, all the way down. And when you breathe out, prolong it. Get all the air out. And again, breathe in deeply into your stomach and all the way out again. And now, shift your focus, continue breathing, but shift your focus to the part of your body that feels slightly tense, more tense than the other parts. It could be your throat, it could be your chest, it could be the stomach, it could be the back, your legs, whatever it is, shift your focus to it and breathe into that part. And when you breathe out, feel that that part is relaxing. Do it a few times, and each time you breathe out, feel that that part is relaxing more and more. The tension that was there is dissipating, dissolving. Just let go. Now return your focus to your breathing. Breathe all the way to your stomach and breathe out slowly, calmly, gradually. Experience whatever experience you're having. Just let it be. Give it permission. Give yourself permission to just be. And with the next breath, quietly, softly, open your eyes. Okay, so now how do I keep you awake for the 45 minutes remaining? We'll see. I'll do my best. Some people connect to meditation immediately. For others, it can take as long as 6 months. But meditation works. Tara Bennett Goleman, in her book, Emotional Alchemy, wonderful book, mindfulness means seeing things as they are without trying to change them. The point is to dissolve our reactions to disturbing emotions, being careful not to reject the emotion itself. In other words, giving ourselves the permission to be human. Everyone experiences these emotions, from the consummate warrior to the consummate merit finder. We all have these. Thing is, do we allow them? Are we mindful of them? And this is how we can dissolve them over time. Remember, 8 weeks of meditation and the brain changes its structure. Much more on that later in our lecture, and I also recommend books then and other exercises that we'll do. Let me move on now, because meditation is the slow, usually gradual change that takes place. Let me move on to the sledgehammer, to the acute change. How do we affect change toward, for example, in meditation, becoming calmer, less anxious, happier, through a more acute approach? Before I describe the specific method, let me draw on something not from positive psychology, but from the other side. Specifically, acute change that comes through post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress disorder, when we go through a difficult trauma, many people experience a change, a permanent change after this trauma. This change comes in the form of higher levels of anxiety. Right after that event, after that sledgehammer falls, often for the rest of their lives, after that traumatic experience, these people become more stressed often, less happy, more depressed, as a result of a single event. Post-traumatic stress disorder actually changes the way our brain works. New neural pathways are created immediately with the sledgehammer, with the shock treatment. And that changes us, if we go through it, often for the rest of our lives. Not always, but often. It actually creates new chemicals that begin to flow as a result of that one experience, or can be one experience. Can be abuse, it can be the Vietnam War. 30% of people who returned from the Vietnam War had post-traumatic stress disorder. 8% of the people who fought in the first Gulf War in 91 had post-traumatic stress disorder. After 9/11, Manhattan, 110th Street and down, the number of people who had PTSD rose from 20,000 overnight, from 20,000 to 60,000. Sledgehammer immediately, and that can have lifelong consequences. So I was looking for something that would have acute emotional change immediately, and I found it. And putting together this course, here is the question that I asked myself. So we know this is in quote-unquote negative psychology. Is there a parallel in positive psychology? Is there a positive shock treatment, an equivalent that can change the way we look at the world, the way we perceive our lives? Instead of bringing about anxiety, get rid of anxiety and bring calmness. Instead of bringing depression, as PTSD does, bring higher levels of happiness. Not get rid of depression and anxiety, impossible, but to make us more prone to happiness, more prone to being a merit finder, more relaxed. Is it possible, just like it's possible with PTSD, with the trauma, to create negative neural pathways, is it possible to create positive neural pathways? In other words, is there a positive equivalent to trauma? And the question I ask myself in thinking about and putting together this course, can a single positive experience create a positive channel that will lead to a permanent increase in well-being, calm, and positive memories? In other words, the exact opposite of post-traumatic stress disorder. And the answer to this is yes. I knew you were tense, you wanted to know, so yes. Yes, there isn't much research on it, but there is beginning to be more and more, and next time we'll get to some fascinating research on it. But the equivalent of the trauma in positive psychology is the peak experience, which you're reading about this week. Maslow is the one who popularized the term peak experience. And here is what Maslow writes. And the important thing about peak experience, that everyone has them. Everyone has peak experiences. The question is, what do we do with this peak experience, right? Not every trauma leads to PTSD. Most people have experienced traumas in their lives, but most people don't have PTSD. But trauma is the foundation. And the question is, how can we make the best of this peak experience? But what is a peak experience? Again, from your readings. The term peak experience is a generalization for the best moments of the human being, for the happiest moments of life, for experiences of ecstasy, rapture, bliss, of the greatest joy. I found that such experiences came from profound aesthetic experiences, such as creative ecstasies, moments of mature love, perfect sexual experiences, parental love, experiences of natural childbirth, and many more. Again, most people have experienced these peak experiences, and you'll get an opportunity to reflect on them in response paper for next week. On some of them, not all of them. You can, but... So the peak experience can be looked at as the quote-unquote positive trauma. But not every trauma leads to PTSD, and not every peak experience leads to a transformation, to a positive transformation. So what is the equivalent of PTSD? It's what I've come to call post-peak experience order. Life can be transformed as a result of a peak experience. William James wrote an entire book on the varieties of religious experiences, essentially talking about how such experiences, religious experiences, change people's lives. In theology, it has been written about for thousands of years. In psychology, more so recently, starting with Maslow, with William James, and then Maslow. And these experiences transform a life forever. And you see it in every great religion. The religious figure had a transformation, a realization, an epiphany that changed his or her life or the followers' lives. And this phenomenon actually happens, and there is research to show it. Here is what Maslow has to say about it. Peak experiences often have consequences. They can do the same there as psychotherapy. If one keeps his goal right, and if one knows just what he is about, and if one is conscious of what he's going toward. We can certainly talk, on the one hand, of the breaking up of symptoms, like the breaking up of cliches, of anxieties, or the like. Or on the other hand, we can talk about the development of spontaneity, and of courage, and of Olympian or godlike humor and suchness, sensory awareness, body awareness, and the like. One of Maslow's students did this research on women who just gave birth, many of whom were, not all, again, just like not everyone has a trauma and PTSD after, not everyone has a peak experience followed by PPEO, after. But what she found was that many women after childbirth were transformed. They became happier, calmer, more generous, and that lasted. In other words, that single experience created new neural pathways. It's not just childbirth, thank God. It's other things. Listening to a piece of music and suddenly everything is one. Walking in the street and suddenly being aware of the unity of it all. And we'll talk about ways how we can maximize the likelihood of achieving peak experience. What peak experience can do, doesn't always do, but what it can do is lead to a new structure of the brain and start new habits, more positive habits. The question is then, or two questions. One, how do we have more peak experiences? How can we maximize the likelihood of having peak experiences? They're not invited usually. Usually they just come. But how can we create the conditions that are more likely to bring them? That's the first question. And the second question, once we have a peak experience, and again, just about everyone, I would actually say everyone has had a peak experience and will have experience. Once we have it, how can we make the most of it so that we're most likely to experience PPEO after? So in psychopathology, what they ask is the opposite question. How can we prevent people who have traumas, who were abused, who went to Vietnam, who are in Iraq now, how can we prevent the traumas that they experienced there, which are almost inevitable, from becoming PTSD? And there's a lot of research on it. What positive psychology asks is the opposite question. How can we take the peak experiences and make it most likely that it will have a lasting effect, that we will have PPEO after that? So these are the two questions. First, enhancing the likelihood of peak experience. I'm going to very briefly talk about just four things, very briefly, because this whole course is essentially about that. Every class can be looked at as a way of having more peak experiences, from the gratitude exercise, which is to make us realize how great our life is, to cognitive reconstruction. All these things make it more likely for us to have peak experiences. But let me mention just a few. The first is acceptance. Acceptance, giving ourselves permission to be human. Acceptance of positive emotions, permission to be happy, and acceptance of negative emotions. Permission to experience anxiety, to be sad, to be upset, to be depressed. Why does this make it more likely to have peak experiences? Because we have one emotional system. If we deprive it of feeling certain negative emotions, we're also automatically depriving ourselves of having negative emotions, because we're repressing a part of this mechanism. The best metaphor for it I read in, I think I may have mentioned it here, in Khalil Gibran's book. Khalil Gibran, who lived where Lebanon is today, was a thinker, philosopher, poet. And in his book, he writes about negative emotions, and he says that each negative emotion, if we allow ourselves to experience it, it's like taking out material from our container of emotions. And taking out that material and making the container of emotions larger and able to hold more positive emotions as well. In other words, each time we have a negative emotion, we allow ourselves the permission to experience it. We also, conversely, allow ourselves to experience positive emotions to a degree, not over and over again and forming negative neural pathways, but to a degree, allowing ourselves also to experience the negative. So first, acceptance, then mindfulness, being present, much more likely to experience, to have a peak experience if we're in the here and now. We can have the peak experience walking right now outside of class and experiencing the breeze or looking at the trees or talking to our friend tonight. We can have it much more likely if we're present. Music, one of the most common ways in which we experience, arouses very strong emotions. But it's not just music in the background. This happens when we're focused on the music, when we really listen to it. When we go to a concert, suddenly we close our eyes and we're just filled with rapture. Or we listen to our favorite song. When we listen to Whitney Houston, for example, my favorite singer. And So that's a peak experience, a potential for peak experience. Meaningful goals. Remember what Maslow said, if we know where we're going, and we're going to devote a whole class to this, to identify what is it that we really, really, really want to do with our lives. And if we're doing the things that we're meant to be doing, we're much more likely to have these peak experiences. Finally, key especially for us here, taking time, relaxing more. When we're stressed, when we're on the treadmill, metaphorically speaking, when we're in the rat race, we're much less likely to have time for peak experiences. It's often when we take time off, and we're going to talk much more about this next week. So once we have the peak experience, how do we make it most likely? Because it doesn't always happen. How do we make us most likely for it to have a positive and lasting change? One is reflecting on the peak experience. Reflecting, thinking about it, because when we think about it, what we're doing is we are reinforcing the neural pathways that were just formed. The best way, arguably, of reflecting on it is through journaling, attaining coherence. And there's a lot of research on this, which we're going to talk about next time, work by Jamie Pennybaker from the University of Texas, work by Laura King, whom we mentioned last time, from UCLA, who show how we can have, and this is direct, direct evidence for the existence of a PPEO, when we journal about peak experiences, and that's going to be your response paper. When we take action, when we don't just leave it at that, when we do something about it, when we follow up on the realization that we just had during this peak experience. For instance, feeling so grateful to our parents and then going and actually writing them a gratitude letter. Following up with action on the realization. And once again, taking time. Taking time, because it's when we take time aside, that's when we have time to assimilate these ideas. Let me move on to behavior, to taking action, the second part of the ABC change taxonomy. I've been attending workshops and seminars, lectures on positive psychology or related areas for over 15 years. It was in a workshop when I was 21 that I had the epiphany when I decided to be a teacher. So I've been going to, I've been to dozens, hundreds of them, every single one you can think of. Some of them were great, excellent, with a lot of substance. Others, just shallow, superficial pop psychology. I've been to the entire gamut, and I've learned from the great ones and also from the not so good ones. Over the last 10 years, I myself have been conducting workshops. I've been working with at-risk youth. I've been working with executives in organizations. I've been working with Harvard students, with high school students, with people in their 70s and 80s, and with middle school students. And what I found always with people coming out, whether from my workshops or classes or seminars, or from other people's workshops and seminars, is that very often people come out with a certain high, with a feeling of, I'm going to make a change. I'm going to look in the mirror. I'm going to change my life. I'm going to make this world a better place. Most people, for most workshops, certainly workshops that succeed over time, otherwise they wouldn't succeed over time, the people come out with a certain high. But then the people are divided into two groups. The first group are the people who experience the high and then very quickly go to base level, go back to base level. If they were slightly happy before, they'll be slightly happy a week later. If they were depressed before, they'll go back to their base level of depression, even though they had that spike. The second group of people similarly has that spike and then is able to maintain it. Maybe not to the same level. If they experienced a peak experience, it's impossible nor desirable to have that all the time. You know, that would be manic. But they were able to sustain a high B or a higher level of change relative to what they had before. So before they were here, they had the high, they went down, but still higher than before. And they were able to effect real, lasting change. Change that lasted beyond the honeymoon phase. Very often it was change to relationships that they were able to introduce. And obviously what I was very interested in was what distinguishes between the two groups. So I did research. And I followed longitudinally people after they graduated from my workshops and other people's workshops, and looked at the kind of change that they experienced. Was it ephemeral, short-lived, or was it long-lasting and permanent? And I found one distinguishing characteristic. Maybe there are others, but I found one distinguishing characteristic between the two groups. Those who enjoyed lasting, permanent change introduced different new behaviors to their lives immediately, usually while taking the workshop, while taking the class. Immediate change, whereas the others experienced the high. They really wanted to change, they had the intentions, but they didn't introduce the behavioral change immediately. And they had the honeymoon, and it was over. Now I start every workshop that I give, and I introduce it in every class that I teach about individual change, the model that explains this phenomena and why we need behavioral change. Because what happens in a workshop is that we change our attitudes, wanting to be more merit finders, wanting to have higher self-esteem. And the attitude usually, not always, but usually changes behavior. So for example, if I have a positive attitude toward self-help books, I'm more likely to read them. If I have a positive attitude toward academic literature, I'm more likely to read that. If I have a positive attitude toward a friend, a person, I'm more likely to want to spend time with that person, and vice versa. So attitude, it's clear, influences behavior. But what psychologists have shown is that it works both ways. It's not just attitude that affects behavior, it's also behavior that affects attitude. And behavior, especially if it's part of a habit, of an ingrained habit neural pathway, our behavior changes the way we think. Remember from a few lectures ago, the mind doesn't like when there is inconsistency between what is in there, attitudes, and what is out there, behavior. And very often after a workshop, even if our behavior, our attitude actually changes, yes, I want to be, I am more of a merit finder, If our behavior doesn't change, we very often go back to the same base level. On the other hand, if I come out of a workshop with a high, I'm going to be more of a merit finder, and then follow up immediately with behavior, write more gratitude letters, do the gratefulness exercise every night, work on my cognitive interpretations, then my behavior and my attitude will be happy on the same line. Behavior has to follow attitude. In this class as well, it's no different. You may look back at the class and say, it was a nice experience, but if you really want to experience change, there's nothing I can do about it. It's all up to you. You may not like all the exercise. You may not feel comfortable doing the gratitude exercise. That's perfectly fine. You may not like keeping a journal. It's perfectly fine. But you have to find behavioral change, real, actual change. It's not enough just to understand it cognitively or emotionally. Action has to follow. It could mean taking risks, speaking up in section or in class, for example. Whatever it is, behavior has to follow. Let me give you a few examples from the literature of behavior changing attitude. Edgar Schein from MIT interviewed POWs in Korea, and what he found was that the POWs would actually change their mind over time when they were prisoners. He interviewed them on the way back to the US. How? They had to write letters home about how wonderful they were treated by their captors and about how terrible the US is. They also had to give talks to their fellow prisoners about these topics. And they actually, over time, changed their mind. They didn't necessarily become communists or hate America. But what he found was that there was an actual change in their attitudes because of their behavior. The mind doesn't like when there is inconsistency between what's in here and what is out there. This is explained by Bem, who writes about self-perception theory. And he says, we form ideas about ourselves by looking at ourselves. So just like if I see you giving someone, helping someone, I will derive from that, likely derive that you're a generous person. The same happens with us. If I see myself, quote unquote, see myself giving, being charitable, I derive from that I'm a charitable person. If I see myself giving speeches about how terrible the US is and how wonderful communism is, I'm likely to derive about myself that I don't like the US and like communism. And there was actual shift in attitude through this self-perception. Facial feedback hypothesis. Fascinating studies showing that when we smile, even if it's artificially, certain endorphins are released, certain chemicals are released. When we frown, different chemicals are released. The body actually reacts as if we were angry or as if we were happy. William James, whistling to keep up courage is no mere figure of speech. On the other hand, sit all day in a moping posture, sigh and reply to everything with a dismal voice, and your melancholy lingers. Smooth the brow, brighten the eye, contract the dorsal rather than the ventral aspect of the frame, and speak in a major key, pass the genial compliment, and your heart must be frigid indeed if it does not gradually thaw. The body, the behavior, influencing our attitudes. So in addition to the facial feedback hypothesis, what we also have is the body feedback hypothesis. Nathaniel Brandon, in some of his other work, talks about this a lot. How people with low self-esteem would usually walk around like this. People with high self-esteem would walk around like a person with high self-esteem. And it's possible to work and change our attitudes about ourselves by changing the way we walk, by changing the way we move. If we shake hand with someone, if we shake it sloppily, what does it communicate versus if we shake it firmly? It doesn't only influence the way we feel about ourselves, it also influences and then reinforces the way other people feel about ourselves. Oh, this must be a person with confidence. Think about these things. There are little things that make a big difference. Fascinating experiment done by Hemmerly and Bandura, sorry, and Zimbardo. The study that they ran was the following. They brought in heterosexual men who were very shy. They identified very shy heterosexual men who were anxious going up and asking women out, for instance. And what they did was they brought them into the lab. And here is what they did. They brought them into the lab and they had them do a bogus study. They thought it was the real study, but it wasn't. But between each part of the studies, they would sit in the waiting room and have a 12-minute conversation with a woman. And the woman, who was a Confederate, was told to be interested in what they had to say, to have a good conversation with them for 12 minutes, and then they thought she was just part of the experiment. And then they were called into the room, and they did the bogus experiment again, and they went back to the waiting room. In the waiting room, another woman waited for them, and again had a great conversation for 12 minutes. They did it 6 times on one day, so 72 minutes of great conversation with 6 women, and 6 times the next day. And then they left, not knowing what the study was about. They measured their anxiety related to the opposite sex a week before, of course, because that's how they found they were shy. A week after, dramatic reduction in anxiety with the opposite sex. They measured it again 6 months later, still far lower. And these men, these shy men, were suddenly dating. <laughs> 144 minutes of intervention changed a lifelong habit of shyness. 6 months later, they came back, and they had to be debriefed, right? We have to debrief. And they were told this was all an experiment. It made no difference, because by then they had already proven to themselves, hey, I'm not shy, I have courage, I can go up to someone and ask her out, and they continue to date significantly more than they did before. Simple intervention, life-changing results. Behavior change. So are you shy? Are you afraid? Remember, courage is not about not having fear. It's about having fear and going ahead anyway. You want to feel happier? Smile. I'm not calling for the great deception here, and I've made this distinction before. Don't have a smile plastered on your face all the time. If you feel like crying, cry. But very often, by walking upright, by shaking hands firmly, by going out of our comfort zone and asking someone out, whether they said yes or no, we can have lasting change. Behavior changing attitude, self-perception. If I see myself going and asking a guy or a woman out, I say, oh, this must be a person with high self-esteem. Self-perception, I will have higher self-esteem as a result. Remember, it's about coping, not about whether she or he says yes or no. Marva Collins. Look at what her parents did, how she became who she is, by behavior-changing attitude.
I think what made me what I am is my parents and a consistency. I mean, I wanted to be as successful as my parents and my grandparents. In those days, it was quite rare to be black and to be successful. So I think the determination of my parents and grandparents, we would get chastised. As I say, I'm 14 years older than my one sister. But if we walked in church and didn't hold our hands up, my mom would say, What was wrong with you today? Walking with your head all down. She would scream down the street, get your head up, on my way to school. People, I've often heard the comment to her, I can always tell your child on the playground. We were brought up with a great sense of pride.
And that sense of pride was communicated to them through behavior. Those whose deeds exceed their wisdom shall endure. But those whose wisdom exceed their wisdom shall not endure. A workshop or a class can only help to a certain degree. It's about taking action. One of the ways to take action is coping, to get out of our comfort zone. Let me tell you two stories. The first story. I was born in Israel. One of my first memories is of the Yom Kippur War, the war in 1973. September 1973, I was 2 years and 10 months old. I remember the phone call to our house on Yom Kippur. No one calls on Yom Kippur. There are no cars in the street in Israel on Yom Kippur. It's the holiest day of the year. And the phone call comes to my dad. My mom and dad start to whisper to each other. My dad puts on his army uniform, walks down, colors the lights of the car with shoe polish, so it's still visible, but not visible in case of an air raid. I still remember him doing it. And then picking me up, kissing me, putting me down, getting into his car, and my mom and I are looking at him and drive away. Our neighbor, who was an elderly gentleman, wasn't called into the army, was standing next to us. And as I see the car moving away, I don't understand what's going on, but I understand that something is wrong. And I could see the expression of the face. I mean, Israel was literally in danger of being extinct as a result of that war, so there was a lot of tension in the air. I could sense it, and I start to cry. The elderly neighbor looks at me and says, Tal, do you want to be a soldier when you grow up? And I say to him, yes, I do. Do you want to be like your dad when you grow up? And I say, yes, I do. Well, he said to me, soldiers don't cry. And I stopped crying for a very, very, very long time. I'm telling you this story to show you the culture that I was brought under, very machoistic, you know, army is a central, you know, just like you go to college here, you go to the army in Israel. You don't even ask questions about it. And this is the culture I was brought up. And one of the things, the main things that I wanted to work on, especially after serving in the military for 3 years and coming to Harvard as an undergrad, was to be more in touch with the parts of myself that are associated with the feminine side. This was one of my targets when coming here. End of story number one. Let me tell you a completely different story that happened recently. I gave a talk for an organization called Strong Women, Strong Girls. Some of you are in it. Lindsay Hyde, the founder, was a student here. She worked with me on making this organization into a national organization when she was a senior, and now I sit on their board. And phenomenal organization, great work. And I gave a talk in one of their events at the YWCA right here in Cambridge. And I talked about resiliency, I talked about self-esteem, motivation, I talked about integrity as critical for the teacher, because it's Harvard women who are teaching young girls, being role models for them. And I talk about all these things, and at the end of the talk, you know, they reward me. And the reward to me was a gift, but it wasn't just any gift, it was a shirt. It wasn't just any shirt, it was a pink shirt. It wasn't just any pink shirt. that I thought it would be, but Lindsay, who handed it over to me, here she is on the side, said, "We only have small sizes, but we still want you to have this." So I said, "Thank you," and then, making a joke, putting my foot in my mouth, I said, "I'll wear it to class." Now, the problem was that one person in the audience was a student in my class. Her name is Tori Martin. And she said, "I'm going to hold you to it." And I said in my mind, and I probably said it out loud, because it was very loud in my mind, "Oy vey." What have I done? I had just talked to them about integrity. I had just talked to them about keeping your word and being a role model. Walk your talk. What have I done? Oy vey indeed. And then, my entire childhood flashing in front of me. My entire childhood, the things I was working on, the things I wanted to change, and Churchill's quote about the optimist who's able to find opportunity in the midst of difficulty. I took his advice and did just that. Ladies and gentlemen, spring 2006. Tyra Banks, here I come. So, I know you may find this hard to believe, but believe me, I'm telling you the truth now when I tell you, this was outside my comfort zone. But there is no other way to change. We have to take risks. We have to cope. We have to put ourselves on the line. And next time we'll talk about how. Thank you.